My name's Rick. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey. Where'd everybody go?
I want to thank the Tuesday Roseville group for the opportunity to be here. Thank you, Doc, for the call on this. Last time I was in Sacramento was when I was 18 years old. I was on the lam. I was running from the police or from prosecution, and I made it my way out to California. We were hitchhiking up the coast with a buddy of mine, and we came up to Sacramento, and then we got ripped off in Sacramento. We lost all our stuff. The guy ripped us off. Yeah, I like it a little better this trip, and that's true. And it was interesting, you know, because this was, somebody had called a radio station, and they announced on the air that there were a couple of guys in town who lost everything and needed a place to stay. And somebody put us up. Somebody called in and put us up for the night, and we worked a little bit for some nuns, did some painting, and then we got a couple sleeping bags, and we decided we'd ride the freight train. So we were on the rail from here up to Tacoma, Washington. So I rode the freight trains back then. And that was an interesting trip. So drunk, just a drunken deal, another one of those. But that was the last experience I had. This is a little town when we came through here. Wasn't much here. But I want to, well, it's great to see all the new people here. I want to give you some of my experiences. A lot of this is my early stuff. But I also want to tell you a little bit about what my childhood was like. I'm the youngest of five kids. I grew up in the south side of Minneapolis, and there's 3 years age difference between all the kids. So I got a brother 3 years older, a sister 6 years older, another brother 9 years older, and one 10 years older than I am. I wasn't close to my older siblings. I really didn't know them very well, my brother Bill and Bob. But my sister Ann I was close to because she was raising me primarily from the time I was probably about, 8 years old on. My mother was working nights. My dad was drunk all the time when I was a kid. He used to work for the post office sorting mail between Chicago and Minneapolis. They used to run the mail on the trains. So he'd be gone for a week and then home for a week. And when he was home, he was drunk. And I didn't want to be around him. And when he was gone, he was gone. So I really didn't know the man throughout my childhood. My mother was working nights, and she was still drinking pretty heavy, and that's the way it was. In fact, probably the only memory that I have of all of the kids in eating at the dinner table one night. I'll tell you. My dad was building a room down in our basement. I grew up in a one-bedroom house, five kids, and we had a bad expansion in the attic. We used to use it for bedrooms. It was just a straight room. 750 square foot house. My cousins had come up from Chicago with four more kids and two adults, and we'd all sleep in this place. It was just bodies everywhere. Those are great memories. Those are not negative. I didn't have a lot of negativity from my childhood. I really didn't. I didn't experience it negative. But that'd be child abuse today, you know. It's kind of sad. But those are really fine memories. The memory of all of us being together. I was the youngest. It was just a lot of fun for me. My dad was building a bedroom down in the basement because we needed the room. And I remember we were talking to kids. We were all sitting around wondering who was going to get that bedroom. See, I knew it wasn't going to be me being the youngest. That much I had down pretty good. Figured my sister would end up in it because she was the only girl in the family. I was amazed when my dad ended up down there. My mother wouldn't sleep with him anymore. He was a sloppy drunk, and he was trouble. He was just a problem. You know, it wasn't that he was mean. He was just a mess. And, he'd make a mess in the bathroom, and she had him. We're eating. All of us are eating in the kitchen. She's got him down the basement, okay, and he's drunk. And we had a kitchen. It was a large enough kitchen so you'd eat in the kitchen. And all of us were sitting there, and my brother Dan's next to me, and my mother is facing the back of the house. She's cooking on the stove, and the basement door is off to the right, and there's a stairway that goes down off of the kitchen. the door swings into the kitchen. And there was a long hallway along where the stairs were, that the other stairway went upstairs, and there was a bathroom at the end of the hall. Well, we used to hang our coats and things on hooks in that hallway. Well, my mother had taken clothesline, and she tied it around the doorknob, and she wove it around the corner to this hook back and forth like that, so my dad couldn't get out of the basement. See, she's got... So she's got him locked down in the basement. He's drunk. She's cooking dinner, and me and Dan and I are sitting there, and we hear the door rattling. He wants to come up, see? And my mother yells, "Get back down there, you," and I won't say what she said. But it wasn't nice. And it quieted down. And about 10 minutes go by, and I happen to be eating, and I'm just going to take a bite of food, and I look up, and all you can see, and this is the strangest sight, all you can see is the end of a saw blade sticking through the crack in the door, you know? He's sawing the ropes. It's a weird sight. And he gets them cut and swings the door open, you know, like, "Hi, you know, here he is." And my mother looks at him, I mean, she just goes nuts. I mean, I'm laughing. This is funny to me. It isn't funny to her, and she looks over, she sees him and grabs one of those big cast iron frying pans, and she goes after him. She's going to club him with this frying pan. My brother Bob got up. He's 20 years old at this point. You know, I was about 10 when this happened. And he gets up and stops her, grabs her, and she's yelling at my dad, and he wanders down the hall and makes a mess in the bathroom, and then he comes wandering back and goes back into the cave. And that was the end of the dinner show, okay? It's the way it was. I didn't think anything of it. It never occurred to me there was anything particularly odd. I thought it was funny. You know, that's not true of my older brothers. My dad died about, probably four years ago now. He was 97 years old. He was sober for quite a few years. I was sitting at Christmas. My dad died right before Christmas. And my brother Bob, who's 10 years older than I am, was sitting there. Very successful businessman. He's made a lot of money. And he's a good guy, but he's hurting. He's in trouble. He's angry at his childhood. We were sitting there, and my dad had just died a couple days earlier. And we were sitting on the couch. And I'm sitting there, and he's sitting next to me like this, and we're talking. And I happened to mention that story to him. There was nothing funny about that to him. He had a different experience in the family than I did, okay? It was tragic to him. His childhood was a nightmare. I remember my second oldest brother, Bill, he died drunk years later after I got sober. I was probably about 8 years sober at the time. And Bill was angry at his childhood. And he told me he used to lay underneath his bed when my parents were fighting in the other room. And he couldn't stand the screaming and the arguing and all the heartache and the trouble that was going on. And he told me, and this is a week before he died drunk, he said he used to lay under his bed and count the bed springs to keep from listening to what was going on in the other room. Now, isn't that sad? That was not my experience, okay? The things that happened that I saw were funny to me, okay? Another guy might need therapy over that stuff, but it just didn't affect me that way. I don't know why it didn't, but it didn't. So I'm in trouble a lot as a kid. I'm in and out of courtrooms. There's not much discipline in my family. So I'm in trouble. I'm in and out of schools. I don't want to learn what they're teaching me. And I'm just trying to have fun. I wasn't mean-spirited. I was just trying to have some fun. They just didn't think it was appropriate where I was doing some of the things I was doing. So my dad would have to bring me back, and my mother would have to bring me back to school and that sort of thing. And it was tough on them. I know that today. But... my dad got sober when I was 11, and he moved out. No great loss to me. I'm hanging with my sister. I'm having a lot of fun. I got to tell you, those were exciting times, living or hanging with my sister. 6 years older, you know, it was just fun for me to be with older people. Those were really great. They were drinking and partying, and I was part of it. It was a treat to be with them. My mother was working nights, and so when my dad got sober and he moved out, it was no great loss to me. I mean, in fact, I started sniffing glue when I was 11. He quit, I started. So, they were talking to me about why I was doing that stuff too. See, we got a lot of conversation. You used to have family meetings. You know, it's never good when you're the topic. It's not. And they'd have these meetings and talk about what they were going to do with me and what my problem was because of the things I was doing. Well, I heard it loud and clear. I'm a product of my circumstances. They were divorced within about a year. And after the divorce, my mother got custody of me. I was the only child under 18 that was living in the house. My brother Dan was in the service. And Ann was over 18 at that point, my sister. So she got the house and she got me. What a deal that was, I guess, you know. And she was drinking. She was partying. She was going out to the bars. And that's the way it was. My sister and I were just hanging together. And those were great memories. She sold the house to my dad within a short time. And he moved in. She moved out. And that's the way I was raised. I lived with my dad and my sister after that. My dad was going to AA. Same situation, working for the post office, gone for a week, home for a week, but he was going to AA meetings. I really didn't know the man. I even through my teenage years living with him, I didn't really know him. And my mother never looked at her alcoholism. She was having a lot of trouble with depression. She had married another alcoholic, met this guy in the bar, same scene, never got out of it. And she used to make me dinners on my birthdays. And I was over there for my 15th birthday. And Dan, my brother Dan, was AWOL from the service. So he and I go over there, and she's going to make me a dinner. And we get there about noon, and she's drinking. I'd been around her drinking a lot. And she was really depressed a lot of times when she'd drink, listening to a lot of heavy blues music, you know. I don't know if you ever heard the old Nat King Cole music or Ray Charles. Oh. God, listen to Ray Charles sober, you want to kill yourself. His early stuff is just unbelievable, you know. And this is the stuff she's listening to, and she's depressed, and she's passing out in a chair at 7, 8 o'clock at night, and that's just the way it was, see. So we're over there for my 15th birthday, get there at noon, she's drinking, I don't like it. She's already, her new husband never surfaces, he never comes out of the bedroom. 3 o'clock in the afternoon, we ate dinner, and she was hammered when we ate. And I did something I'd never done before. I got in her face about her drinking. I called her a drunk to her face. And it was a sullen, negative afternoon from that point. Just a bad scene. And it had snowed real hard that day. And I wanted to get out of there. And we called the cab after we ate. And it took the cab a couple hours to get there because of the snowfall. And I tell you, it was just an uncomfortable 2.5 hours that we had to sit there in that. Cab came, and I was thrilled to death to see that, and we got in the cab, and my brother Dan told me years later, I'd forgotten about this, conveniently, I'm sure. She had asked me to take my birthday cake. No, I don't want it. I'm going to punish her, see. Don't want the birthday cake. I'm going to show her my displeasure with her behavior. I remember we in the cab driving off, I see her waving, and I'm just angry. I'm an angry young man, 15 years old. That night, she killed herself, committed suicide, shot herself with her husband's handgun. Okay. Well, that's alcoholism. That's where this thing goes, guys. You guys who are new, that's where this leads, believe it or not, if you don't sober up. And you'll see it time and time again. Here were things that people were talking to me about. Look, give the kid a break. Look at the family he comes from. And you could make a case for this. I'm not disputing that. Comes from an alcoholic family. There's divorce and now suicide. See, now because I'm in trouble with the law, they do something in Minnesota called a pre-sentence investigation. When you're under 18, before they sentence you, they investigate what your circumstances are like. I heard it loud and clear. I'm a product of my circumstances. I got a break often when I shouldn't have gotten a break. Just the way it was, okay? I did have enough sense to get along with the probation officers and things like that. I wasn't an idiot. I had buddies who didn't do that, and they were in trouble all the time. But I had enough sense to at least to do that. And I got out of a lot of trouble because of the circumstances of my life. I got to tell you, if there's one thing that's caused me more problems in my life than anything else, it's this idea that somebody else is responsible for why I am the way I am and why my circumstances and the events in my life are a problem. And I got to tell you, I used that. I used that to the best of my ability, and it got me out of a lot of heartache, I'll tell you, over the years. But it also caused me to become more and more angry. And as I grew older, that's really what happened. I come in here with just a tremendous amount of resentment. And it was perfectly justified. Not only that, but I had people telling me I was right, which makes it even worse. So that's the way my mind was as I went along. And you're going to drink when you got a mind and you're angry, and you got to do something to relieve the pressure. So and I'll give you a quick story of how we drank, because this is typical of the way I was. I drank with enthusiasm, great enthusiasm. I'll tell you how we do it. And this is common. We would generally do it this way. We'd get a keg of beer, an 8-gallon keg of beer, me and my buddies, from about 14, 15 years old on. We'd get an 8-gallon keg and four guys. Right? It's the right amount for four guys, isn't it? That's 2 gallons apiece is approximately 24 12-ounce bottles each. That's the right amount, isn't it? Maybe you're in the wrong room if you don't think that's the right amount. If we had five guys, we'd buy a 16-gallon keg. You never put five guys on an 8. It wasn't enough beer. So we're drinking for effect. And we did this right from the start. I'm telling you. We'd get the keg. We'd put it in somebody's living room. We'd take it down to the river. I live in Minneapolis. The river runs right between Minneapolis, St. Paul, to Mississippi. We'd go down there and we'd drink and we'd stand around the keg. And as we stood around the keg, we'd put each other down. That was the game. Okay, and the guy who could do it the best won some sort of a prize for negativity or insanity or something. I was good at this. My humor was directed at people. It was sarcastic. It was negative. And people don't want you around when you're like that. Normal people. Halfway through that keg, you'd be fist fighting in the river with your buddies, because these were great opportunities to tell them exactly how you felt about them. You're hanging around with them all the time and you got grievances. So you... Halfway through the keg, all the defenses were down, and you'd be fighting, and that's the way it was. And normal people, when you're at their houses doing this stuff, they don't want you around, so you don't get invited back, and then you build cases against them because of the way they're treating you. Yeah, it's exactly what I did. Yeah, started to reject groups of people. It's called prejudice, and what a mind, When you got a mind like this, you got to medicate it, see? I want to tell you something else. Another thing that happened to me early on, just an early experience. I was 5 years old. And I tell you this because it illustrates the way my mind was. When I was five, they gave me a little cap gun with little rolls of caps, little dots of gunpowder. For you guys who are too young to know that. Anyway, it's a paper roll with little dots on it. You pull the trigger, you get a little pop. I'm five. I don't like the little pop. I want the big explosion, see? Okay, so I found out if you take the caps out of the gun, leave it rolled up and hit it with a hammer, the whole roll goes off, right? I like a good enthusiastic group, That's a... Yeah, so I'm going through a lot of caps, okay? My mother won't buy me any more caps. I'm going through a lot of them, So we're down at a hardware store, my brother Dan and I'm five, he's eight. And I see my mother's off shopping, and I see the caps on the shelf. 5 years old, I made a conscious decision to steal those caps. I did. So I took a handful, and I stuck them in my pocket. They're little boxes. And I grabbed another handful. I was just going to put them in my pocket, and Dan's next to me. He says, "Rick, that guy over there saw you." So I shoved them in his pocket, and he got caught. That's a true story. Dan told me years later, he says, "I've been nervous around you ever since." Well, can you blame him? Here I am. I'm stealing and trying to give him the problem, I told that story 20-some years ago in front of a small group, and a guy come up to me, and he says, "I had a similar experience to that. I was 5 years old. I got caught stealing, and I never stole again." Not me. I went on stealing and trying to give the problem to somebody else. That's been a common theme in my life. Now, what did any of that have to do with my family? Nothing. I didn't know anything about alcoholism. My mother hadn't died. I didn't know anything about divorce. No, no, this is the way my mind was at 5 years old. I do everything with enthusiasm. Well, don't you? Well, if you wouldn't be in this room if you didn't. I mean, really. You know, the only thing drunks don't do with enthusiasm? The steps. You know? You ever notice that? They come in here, they go, oh, I need balance now. Why? Why don't you do this enthusiastically? Oh, no. Easy does it. They take the slogans, and they kill themselves with the slogans. Oh, easy does it. No, do this enthusiastically. You'll get well enthusiastic. Oh, no. No, no. Easy does it. I need balance now. This is insanity. I tell you, that is not my journey. I came in here, I was going to get out of where I was. I was not going to be depressed sober. And I made a decision real early on. Well, I'll tell you what it was. This is the way this thing was at a very early age. It's just the way I thought. It's the way I acted. I acted on those thoughts. And I was constantly in and out of courtrooms and in and out of jail cells. Pam and I got together. We had an 11-year relationship and two boys. My boys were 4 and 6 years old when I got sober. And I got to tell you, it was tough. It was tough for her. I tell you, I wouldn't. We split up when I was 2.5 months sober. And I got to tell you, if she would have been doing to me for 3 months what I did to her for 11 years, I'd have left her. I wouldn't have put up with it. I got to tell you, I went to Al-Anon. I got into Al-Anon pretty early on in AA. I was 3 months sober. I walked into an Al-Anon meeting, and I sat there and I listened. And I got there because I couldn't control people and circumstance. I was just angry, and I was sober, and I was trying to do inventory. But some of this is pre-inventory stuff, see? And I was really miserable. And in fact, you might think, well, why would you go to Al-Anon? Can't you get everything you need from Alcoholics Anonymous? Sure, I suppose you could, you know, but I couldn't. Maybe you can. I don't know. I couldn't. But I can tell you in one sentence why I go. I go to AA to keep from committing suicide, and I go to Al-Anon to keep from committing murder. The Al-Anons understand that. Trust me. I've been going every week for 20, I'll have 20, in fact, I got 24 years already in Al-Anon. So I go every week. I've been doing it for a long time. Sit and listen. You get a real dose of reality. It isn't always pleasant either, but it's reality. And you get a sense of what it feels like to be on the other side of alcoholism. It's a nightmare, guys. Seriously, I wouldn't have spent 3 months with her if she was doing what I did to her for 11 years. So I dish it out, but I don't take it so well. I don't like it when people do it to me. I'll tell you, it's made my sponsorship safer. It really has. Oh, really? It will, too. You can't get away with that controlling stuff and telling people what to do. You can't do that, you know. They made me look at that stuff. And that helped me. It made me much safer as a sponsor. In fact, you know, today, for me, I can tell you, sponsorship for me, I think the purpose of sponsorship for me is to make yourself unnecessary. Not to breed dependence on me, but to literally bring a guy through a process of inventory and let him, he can make his own decisions. I'm not going to make decisions for him. You know, when I quit solving people's problems, they quit calling me. Used to get those 2 o'clock in the morning stuff. I don't get that anymore, you know. Put inventory in front of them. You'll weed them out real quick. You'll find out who's serious and who isn't. There's no sense wasting your time arguing with people who aren't interested. That's my experience anyway. So I drank with enthusiasm, and if you'll do that, you'll end up in Alcoholics Anonymous at some point, and that's exactly what happened. And near the end, I was doing a lot of crazy things, and I was doing other, as people say, outside issues, and it doesn't really matter. But I was involved in a lot of illegal stuff, and I was trying to go to an outpatient treatment program to get my family back, and I wasn't going to stop using. I was just going to this outpatient treatment program so Pam would come back. I thought, I guess, that I could manipulate her to come back one more time, and I wasn't going to change. I don't know why I thought she'd stay. I mean, it's amazing how delusional you become as you drink. And I went across the street from the group. There was a Social Security office across the street, and I went into the Social Security office with the idea. We used to make up birth certificates. I had impression stamp. You know, you could get a new identity. I used to sell identities. Okay, it's a long story, but I wanted Social Security cards to go with the birth certificate. So I was going to go into the Social Security office and plant records in their files and get Social Security cards. It's just absurd. I'm insane at this point. And I'm going to treatment across the street, see, an outpatient treatment program. And I had this bright idea because I was doing business with the Social Security office. I had a store called Chicago Supply Company, and it was an antique plumbing fixture store. And I was doing business with the Social Security office. I was going to buy desks and things from them, so I got this bright idea one day to maybe I could get Social Security cards to go with those birth certificates we're making up. And, boy, that'd be valuable because we were selling them anyway. And I went in there, and I climbed up on the ceiling of the bathroom and waited for them to close. And then after they closed, I came down. I was going to steal a bunch of stuff. And, you know, I was in there for about 6 hours. I didn't do anything I thought I was going to do, you know. And then I opened the computer room. The cops, the alarm went off. The police were there in just a couple minutes. And I went back up on the ceiling and hid from them for 2.5 days. Had some time to think about how good my life was going at that point, you know? Federal charge, you do a lot of time on federal stuff. You get a 5-year sentence, you're not getting out in 18 months. You're going to do 90% of that, you know? And I don't like being locked up, and it got my attention. You know what I saw hiding in the ceiling? It occurred to me that... it did, it really did. What came to me was, Rick, you're out of control. Now, people had been telling me this almost all my life. You're out of control. But it didn't matter if they saw it. I needed to see it. And until I saw it, it didn't make much difference. See? You could tell me anything. It doesn't matter if I'm not the one who sees it. Well, I saw it. And I realized it was only a matter of time before I was going to catch a case and go to jail for a long time. And I knew that. I got out of there without going to jail, fingerprints all over this place. I really expected that. I went into a real treatment center because outpatient wasn't working so good. And I went into a real treatment center, and I started into withdrawal, and I started coming off all kinds of stuff. And 3 weeks of just absolute craziness. And I'm laying in this treatment center, and I'm thinking about my life. Pam has left. She's taken the kids. I lost the house we were living in. I had $50,000 in equity in this one house. This is in the late 80s, mid-80s, gone in a foreclosure. I was losing my business. I'd moved that twice, and I had to move it again. And this is unbelievable to even consider moving once, let alone three times. I mean, it's just, I can't even tell you how absurd that is. Clawfoot bathtubs, radiators for houses, you know what I mean? Hundreds of sinks, hundreds of toilets, antique stuff, you got to pack it. Everything's fragile. It's a nightmare, see? And I'm thinking about all these things as I'm laying in this treatment center. My children are gone. Everything's gone, and it looks like I might go to jail on this thing with the Social Security office. And I came to a place in my mind where I said something that I don't even know why I said it, but I did. I was so frustrated. I'm a militant atheist, guys. I don't believe in God. In fact, I was raised, just to give you, my parents, my dad was really a red. He was a communist. They were. And he had a friend named Joe Stern who had a lumber yard that I used to work for from the time I was 12 years old until I was in my late 20s. And I sat in that lumber truck with Joe, and these guys were speaking on street corners, organizing labor stuff, doing all, and they were communists. They were going over to the Soviet Union. They were going over to Cuba. I'm talking about in the 60s when this isn't the kind of stuff you wanted to be doing back then. The Daily Worker paper was a communist paper that would come with a brown wrapper over the cover so nobody knew what it was. It came anonymous, okay? Because you didn't want this would come to the door. So this is the way I'm raised. I got all these ideas about it. And if you're really a communist, you're an atheist. So I got my communist training in that lumber truck and my atheist training at the same time. So now I'm in this treatment center, and I've been a pain to people, guys. In the bars, I'd be hammering on Christians. I was not a nice guy. I was aggressive. I had all the arguments from listening to Joe and my dad, and I was just a pain. Here I am growing up in my teenage years in a capitalist country with all these communist ideas, and I'm slamming this stuff out there when we're drinking, and it's conflict everywhere, you know? That's the way I was. Now I'm in this treatment center, and I've been through a bunch of withdrawals, and I just can't stand my life. I've been going in and out of courtrooms. I'm hawking my stolen stuff to pay attorneys I don't like, you know? I hated the, they were as arrogant, I know, I can't even say that. I was more arrogant than they were, okay? And I'm telling them how to run the case and all that. You know, I'm just insane. So I've got all this, Jehovah Witnesses that come to my door. I said, come on in, we'll talk, you know? And I'd get them, I'm not proud of this. I'm telling you, these were kind, loving people coming to carry a message of love to a madman. And I'd get them in the house, I'd start grinding on them. They'd be running on the block after about 10 minutes with me. It is not, I'm not proud of that. It was ugly, but this is where I was at, and I was aggressive. So now I'm laying in this treatment center, and I said, I can't stand this anymore. I'll do anything not to live this way, anything. As soon as I said it, I had this experience. When I made that commitment, I felt these, it's like electricity, like somebody plugged me into the wall. I felt this electricity run through my body, and it came from this way, through my head, down through my feet. One wave after another, and it was so intense I could hardly stand it. It just, one right after another, I'll do anything. This peace comes over me like I'd never experienced before, with a sense of knowing that everything will be okay if I just stick to the commitment I just made, meaning I'll do anything. The experience was tremendous. I can't even describe it to you. It was very peaceful and loving. And then I get this in my head, and I almost died when I heard this. Jesus Christ. And I went, whoa, no, not me. You know the background I got. No, I can't handle that. I said, no, I couldn't. It shocked me when this happened. And I said no, and the experience ended when I did that. I've never had trouble staying sober since I made that commitment. The compulsion to use was shut off like a switch. I've never struggled with urges, nothing, gone, simply gone. In fact, now I can see that I entered into a commitment with God, and I didn't even believe in God. Now, if you're new, you might think that that has to be a big barrier. I'm telling you, that is not a barrier here in Alcoholics Anonymous. It doesn't have to be at all. And I'll tell you, I'll share some things with you of what I did with all of that and what's happened to me, okay? I entered into that commitment. I said, I'll do anything, and I meant it, and I still mean it. And that commitment is still in force today. I've never, when I walked into AA, AA never looked like a program of not drinking. It just didn't. How right that is. It seems like it should be, but it's not. And this is what I saw. And because it was shut off, it never occurred to me to think of the first step in terms of alcohol, because it was gone. But I come in with all my old ideas, all my atheist stuff, all my rebelliousness, my angry, militant stuff. And I had to deal with that stuff somehow. So what do you do with that when you come in and you have this? You know, just because I had that experience didn't mean it converted me. I was still an atheist. I mean, the ability of the mind to deny what happens is astonishing. But I denied the experience. But I couldn't deny that I was different and that alcohol was shut off. It was just gone. That happened 24 years ago, and it's never come back. And that's the way it is. So a while back, somebody sent me something I want to share with you, because the longer I'm sober, the more I can see how significant that commitment was. If I got it here with me. Somebody sent me this in the mail. I don't even know where it came from. They just sent it one day. Here's what it says. It says, the moment one definitely commits oneself, then providence moves too. All sorts of things occur to help one that would never otherwise have occurred. Oh, yeah. A whole stream of events issues from the decision. raising in one's favor all manner of unforeseen incidents and meetings and material assistance, which no man could have dreamed would have come his way. Boy, that really describes what's happened to me since that experience. It's been like a fairy tale, like a Cinderella story. My life is so strange from that point, and illogical, absolutely illogical, something that was very difficult for me to grasp. You know, I had this logical mind. What do you do with that? You know, the whole Alcoholics Anonymous book is written from the perspective of what they did, not what they think we should do. They wrote, this is what we did that worked, okay? I had lots of theories of how life should go. If I could just get my family back, if I just get my money back, and Pam didn't come back. I couldn't get her back, and I had to deal with that relationship, and I had to deal with that loss, okay? And lots of us have that experience. But that didn't mean I couldn't practice these principles in dealing with her, whether she came back or not. Today, her and I are close. She's remarried. In fact, I pick her up on Sunday nights when she's willing to go, and I take her to Al-Anon with me. Yeah, her husband's using again, off and on, see? So she comes with me. I've never been rejected from that family because I cleaned up my mess with them. I went back and I talked to her and her family, and I made my amends, and I dealt with those people. I admitted I was wrong. And it made all the difference in the world. So I'm really grateful for utilizing the program, especially around the amends steps, and following what they said to do. So, forgot where I was at. Anyway, so I've got this logic, okay, going on. And the difference between theory and experience is really tremendous. I'll give you an example. I was watching a video years ago of a guy who invented a helicopter. His name was Arthur Young. And I was watching all this stuff to try and grasp spirituality. I'm trying to figure out God, and I don't understand it. I'm sitting in meetings, I'm listening to people talk about God, and I can't believe it. You know, I can't accept what they accept. I can't force myself to believe what I don't believe, see? So I'm in this struggle. So if you're having this, it doesn't have to be a problem. But it was a problem for me. So I'm watching this video of this guy, and he was talking about spirituality, and he was talking about inventing things. He said they had theories of how the helicopter should fly. He said their theories were based in logic, and then what they would do is, by logic, if they did A, B, and C, D should follow. The thing should fly, okay? Then he said they would build a model. So they'd build a little model of the helicopter and fly it to see if it worked. He said often when they did this, the model didn't obey their theories. In other words, it didn't work the way they thought it would. But they didn't say that their experience was wrong and the theories were right. No matter how logical their theories, they adapted their theories to the experience. The experience is what's true. Any reasonable mind would do that. It's not what I was doing. I come into AA, I got theories of how things should be. And I thought, you know, I just got to work it harder. And then oh, this is a problem, you know. Then I started pouring more energy in trying to force solutions and make things go the way I wanted them to go. And guess what? It got worse. It didn't get better. Never did it occur to me to not do what I was doing. Why? Because it was logical. It made sense. It should work. But it wasn't working. But it should work. Oh, I just about destroyed myself with that. Because I'm a guy who does things enthusiastically. See? Should work. It's not working. I couldn't let go. You know, when I did finally get to a place where every time I fixed something, it got worse. You ever had that experience? That's really bad when you don't believe in God, okay? Every time you solve a problem, it gets worse. Finally, I got to a point where I just gave up. I just simply stopped fixing everything. You know what? My life got remarkably better. It did, in spite of my help. Not because of it. And I got to tell you, I actually became afraid of myself and my ability to deal with things. Sober, see? Maybe especially sober. Well, that's the difference between theory and experience. The logic was keeping me. You know what it'll do? It'll keep you hanging on to stuff that's not working, that makes sense. And then, conversely, it'll keep you from trying things that might work that don't make sense. Now, this is what the big book is. It didn't make any sense to me. But I'm telling you, I was reading the family afterwards because I had so much trouble in my family. And I'm reading this stuff, and I'm about 2.5 months sober, and I hear a voice in my head that says, it sounds like my voice, okay? It says, just do what they did. And I thought, that's a good idea. I think I'll just do what they did. So I went back through chapter 5, I opened the book, and I did what they did. I just did it. I didn't have anybody pushing at me or showing me anything. I just simply let the book sponsor me. This is just the way it was. I'm not recommending it or anything. I'm just telling you what happened. Okay? If you got somebody who can help you, that's wonderful. I didn't have somebody. I wasn't willing to do that, I guess. But I was willing to do the process. And I knew AA worked because my dad got sober. And I didn't like him, but I knew it worked because I saw him stay sober. See, and his life changed. I opened up chapter 5 and it starts out, and we read it here. It says, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Those who do not recover, us in this room who won't recover, are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program. Cannot or will not. I've seen lots of people who would not do it, but I've seen very few that couldn't. But I have run into a couple. And one of them sober today. He just couldn't do it. And one day something shifted and he did it. It's amazing. So I don't know where to draw those lines, but that's what it's going to be. Will not, cannot or will not completely give myself to this simple program. Who are they? Usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. You know how I heard that? Honest with everybody else. Come to realize I had a lot of company with that idea over the years, okay? But that's not what it says. It doesn't say. I remember thinking, if I stop stealing and I stop lying, I'll be working a program. And I would say today, that's really not got much to do with what we're talking about here. You may disagree with that, but I'll tell you why I think that. What we're really talking about, the more you look at the process in the Alcoholics Anonymous book, what we're really talking about is how dishonest I am with myself. Now, I remember thinking when I heard that from a guy, I thought, come on, I don't lie to myself. That's ridiculous. Certainly I lie to others. That wasn't news, you know. But I tell myself the truth. Wow, how little I'd looked. We're talking about self-deception. Now you say, come on, I don't have self-deception. I'd say, really? How do you know? How do you know? How do you know you don't have self-deception? Isn't self-deception the guy who's got it don't know it? You don't know you got it until you get past it, right? You ever been wrong when you were sure you were right? You know, you get some new information later on, and you find out you're wrong, and you would have been anything you were right? Yeah, I had I'll give you an experience. I had 12 years sober, this happened to me. I was asked to speak at a meeting. And Michael was the guy I sponsored, and we're talking to him after the talk, and I said to him, Todd's here. He says, yeah. I said, I don't think he likes me. He said, why? So I told him, this is what I told him. I met him when I was in my first year of sobriety. Todd was a little younger than I am. He was a bright young man going to school to be a playwright, and I liked Todd a lot. He's a soft-spoken guy, good guy, sober longer than I was. And I saw him in my first year of sobriety at this one meeting. Then he disappeared out of the meeting. I hadn't seen him. So the first time I saw him was at a conference. And it was a big conference, and it was in between when the meeting was on. I went to the restroom, and I'm coming back from the bathrooms, and it's a wide hallway, probably half the width of this room. And I'm on one side going back to the meeting room. He's coming down this way, and I look, and I see him, and it's quiet. See, it's in the meeting's going on. And I said, hi, Todd. How you doing? Walked right by me. I thought, wow, what's that? I didn't do anything to him, you know. Last time I saw him, I thought I don't know what that was. Next time I saw him, maybe a year later, it was at a meeting. And he's sitting just where this white chair, maybe a little further away, and he's facing that way. And the meeting's getting ready to start, and I looked at him, and I went, hey, Todd, how you doing? Wouldn't even look at me. I thought, whoa, what the heck's this? You know, when you have experiences like that, you got to talk to some people about it. You know what I mean? You got to tell somebody what a jerk Todd is, right? Because he's not treating you right. See? So I'll bet I had 6 more experiences similar to that over the next 12 years, or total of 12 years. So I'm telling this to Michael. Michael looks at me and he says, "Don't you know?" I said, "What?" He said, "Todd's got diabetes really bad, and his eyesight was going, and he had another illness, and he couldn't hear much." Now, who would have thought that? He's in his 40s, for crying out loud. You know, Todd died from those illnesses about 4 years later. In his 40s. Now, who would have thought that? Self-deception. I believed in what I saw. I believed in my perceptions. Then Michael made it even worse. He said, "You know, Todd's the one who asked me to get you to speak here tonight." Oh, boy, you feel pretty small when stuff like that happens. Here I'd been talking to people about him, telling them what a jerk Todd is. You know, you got to talk to people, right? Well, if you've ever had an experience like that, and I did 12 years of that nonsense, sober. If you've ever had an experience like that when you were sure you were right and you get some new information and find out you're wrong, then I would ask this. What makes me so sure I'm right today as I stand here? If I've been wrong before when I was sure I was right, I could be wrong about a lot of things as I stand here today. Maybe it just hasn't been revealed to me yet. Maybe I'm living under the illusion of a lot of things. Like somebody doesn't like me. Who does? See, I had a story. Well, we're going to ask you guys who are new, we're going to ask you to, in an inventory process, to look at the stories you're telling yourself and others that justify your anger. That's what we're going to do. Why? Because the anger is hurting me, not the guy I'm angry at, first of all. So we're going to look at these things and see if we can't spot our self-deceptions, because there's a tendency to distort things. It took me 12 years to see that. Maybe I can start to see this stuff before I make a fool of myself like that. That'd be helpful. In fact, I'd like that, you know. I get tired of that crap. But it doesn't stop me from making snap decisions and judgments based on perceptions. And I've been wrong so often that it's just sad that I keep doing it. But I'm better. You have to know what a problem is if you're going to solve a problem. So the thing about honesty is the first idea. I got to be honest with myself. I found I can be very honest with others and very dishonest with myself. So we're going to learn to spot the self-deceptions. But you got to know what a problem is, what the problem is if you're going to solve it, right? So on page 62 of the big book, it says selfishness, self-centeredness. That we think is the root of our troubles. Boy, that sounds kind of weird, doesn't it, if you're new? Selfishness is the root of my troubles? Yeah, that's what it says. Alcohol's not the root of my troubles? No. Selfishness, yeah. How could that be? Well, the next sentence, it says, driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity, we step on the toes of our fellows and they retaliate. Wow. Is that what's been going on? Maybe, maybe not, I don't know. You'll have to look at it. I had to look at it. I saw that that's what's been going on. I've been stepping on the toes of others. I've been driven by my fears. What am I afraid of? I'm afraid I won't get what I want. I'm selfish. I'm afraid I'll lose what I got. I'm selfish. I'm driven by 100 forms of fear of losing what I got, not getting what I want. Then it says self-delusion. I distort things. Self-seeking, I'm only concerned about Rick. And self-pity, I feel sorry for myself when I don't get what I want. What happens? I step on the toes of my fellows and they retaliate. Then I look at their retaliation and I think, what a jerk. Look at the way they're treating me. And they are treating me badly because they don't like being manipulated and controlled for my benefit. You know? People don't like that stuff. And I'm totally unaware that I am selfish at all, so I just think they're attacking me. Right? And my anger is perfectly justified. I mean, I'm not going to tell you your anger is not justified. Of course it's justified the way you tell the story. In fact, the story is the justification for the anger. That's the first 3 columns on page 65. It's exactly what it is. That's the problem, not the solution on page 65. We're just trying to get our stories down so we know what the problem, what's going on, what I'm angry about. Luckily, it's a 4-column inventory. But selfishness is the problem. Why? Because I become angry. I get angry when I don't get what I want. Don't you? Yeah, it irritates me when things don't go the way I want it. You know, and we're going to ask a person to look at the stories looking for the selfishness behind the anger. You know, you read that story of the actor in the Big Book, and that literally is a description of how the mind builds resentment. It's an actual description of what happens when you live on self-will or selfish. And what happens is I end up angry if I don't get what I want. And that's just been the way it's been. So the more I've started to look at this stuff, the more I realize, my God, I'm angry at my own expectations of people. I had an idea of how my dad should be, then I hated him for my idea of how he should be. I'm angry at my own expectation. It has nothing to do with my dad. I expected an alcoholic to be normal. If you expect a lunatic to be normal, who's crazy? You know? Well, I started to see this. So we're going to look at our stories and look for the selfishness behind the anger. But you know, in between the first three columns and the fourth column, there's kind of an interesting thing that happens. This is Bill does something that I think is brilliant. He says we're going to says this was our course. We realized that the people who wronged us were perhaps spiritually sick. Perhaps these people I'm angry at are spiritually sick. I felt kind of offended by that. I almost quit reading the Big Book at that point because I thought, what a bunch of crap. We're going to justify crappy behavior. See, that's not what it is. Okay, but that's what I felt. But it says after that, and this is brilliant to me. This is just the brilliance of what they wrote. He says, perhaps they're spiritually sick. It says, though we did not like their symptoms. I don't like the symptoms of their spiritual sickness. You know what they did to me? And the way these disturbed us, they, like ourselves, were sick too. Wow, that's self-forgiveness. They, like ourselves, were sick too. Look, do I want compassion and understanding for my mistakes, for the dumb things I've done out of my addictions? You know, I wanted Pam to give me a break and come back and bring the family back. I didn't want to lose my family. I would have done anything to get her to come back. Anything. I was manipulative and controlling. I was crazy. And I would have told you it was because I loved her so much, which is true, and the kids. But you know, there was another side of this I saw later. I hated my dad for doing what he did to our family when I was a kid, and the last thing I wanted to do was do what he did. But you know what? It was too late. I'd already done it. And if she wouldn't come back, then all that judgment I had for my dad was on me. And I saw that even before I did inventory. So this is self-forgiveness. Do I want compassion and understanding when I've stolen from people I loved, when I've ruined relationships because I couldn't control myself sexually, I did something stupid when I was drunk? Do I want people to give me a break? Yeah. Well, guess what? I'm going to have to give that to other people then. Why? Because I'm judging myself as harshly as I judge everybody else. And if other people can't make mistakes in my mind and I want them punished for the mistakes that they make, what am I saying to myself? For the dumb things I've done. Same thing. So Bill's saying, you're going to forgive yourself by seeing them differently. That's what it is. That's what the sense of this is. So how do you do it? It says, we ask God to help us. We ask God to help us. You know, I've sponsored guys and I've gotten in the middle of that. And I've tried to, here, why don't you look at it this way? Or why don't you look at it that way? You know, I stopped doing that. And I'll tell you why I stopped doing it. I quit doing that because I was literally trying to force a solution that I thought he should see it that way. And I quit doing that. This process, for me, when I'm sponsoring guys, works a lot better if you let them write that in the privacy of their mind, asking God to help them see it differently, not me. And I'm telling you, amazing things come in maybe a fifth step or something after the guy's done some of that work anyway. But generally, it starts to shake loose in ways that I could never imagine them hearing it or try and bring it about. So we ask God to help us show them the same tolerance, pity, and patience we would cheerfully grant a sick friend. When a person offended, we said to ourselves, "This is a sick man, how can I be helpful to him? God save me from being angry, thy will be done." See, that's really the fourth column. Referring to our list again, putting out of our minds the wrongs others had done, we resolutely looked for our own mistakes. You know, it doesn't say our part. I don't know if you guys do that here much, but it's all over Minneapolis-St. Paul area. We're looking for our part. That is not what the book says. The book says we're going to look for our mistakes, and we're going to put out of our mind the wrongs others had done. If I'm looking for my part, I'm not putting out of my mind the wrongs others had done. And you know what happens? You keep justifying what you did by what they did. I've had to stop looking at them. On the inventory, we put the first three columns on the front, and then we put the fourth column on the back of the sheet. So when you put out of your mind the wrongs others had done, you turn the sheet over and it's not facing you. And then we put our own mistakes and then the questions. Where was I selfish? Where was I dishonest? Where was I self-seeking and frightened? I'm telling you, when I started to write that, you know what I saw? My stories weren't accurate. I didn't see that I was bad. I saw I was wrong. What's the matter with being wrong? It's devastating if you've been hating your dad for 25 years based on a story that's not even accurate, yet it's freeing at the same time. You'd think it'd make you feel guilty. It didn't. It took my guilt away. I was making myself guilty by judging other people for their mistakes. I'll give you a prime example of how this plays out in a guy's life. A guy asked me to sponsor him. I was a year sober. This happened when I was a year sober. He was 3 years sober. He says, "Will you sponsor me? I've made a commitment to AA, and I'm sincere about my commitment. I've never lost that. So I'm going to help him. But I can't stand to be around him because he's a thief." I've been a thief all my life. Okay? You might say, "Well, I'm not a thief. How come I react to people who steal?" How about in relationships? Do you go into relationships to get something? You know, I want to get to know the woman or man with a lot of money who can, you know, take care of me. I stay in relationships long after the relationship should have ended because I'm afraid of being alone. I'm using the person for company. I don't even like her or him. Yeah. In fact, I hate her. But I like the sex. You know what I mean? Using her. Yeah. It's not very pretty when you start looking at it that way, is it? I'm a thief in relationships. Well, I've been a thief in both areas. You know what I saw after I was sober a while? I took and took and took until I had nothing left. Think you'd have something, wouldn't you? Christians said it. What you sow, you reap. On the streets, what goes around comes around. You're going to receive what you give. What if you're taking from life? You're going to lose. I took and took and took until it was all gone. I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous, I had nothing left. Think you'd have something, wouldn't you? Had nothing left. It was gone. Was I receiving what I was giving? Yeah, I was taking and I was losing. That's right. So this thing with this guy, he's a thief. And I've changed my behavior. I've stopped stealing. But I'm still judgmental about stealing. And you know what the problem with that is? You'll feel better initially because you're no longer acting out of accord with your judgmentalness. You brought your behavior into accord with stealing's bad. I'm not stealing anymore, so I feel better. Then this guy shows up. He says, "Will you sponsor me?" And he's a thief. And I don't want to help him. I want to kill him. Every time I'm around him, I want to strangle him. And I don't even know what's going on. We call that sponsorship. Yeah. And then you set out to get him to change so you'll feel better. You ever seen that one? You beat him over the head with the big book. You know, it says rigorously honest in here, and you slam him over it, you know? Well, you might even get the poor guy to change, and guess what? You'll never see the problems in you. But you know what? I saw it. I saw that whenever I came to him with judgment and condemnation, I felt the guilt. I was reinforcing my own guilt from when I used to steal. When I came with compassion and understanding, I gave that to myself. That's the choice I've got. No Alcoholics Anonymous. This has always been the choice in life. I'm always going to receive what I'm giving. Wow, this woke me up. That guy came into my life to show me, to teach me. Here I thought I was going to teach him something. He woke me up. In fact, he healed me, because the more I had compassion for him, the more I had compassion for myself when I used to steal. And eventually you won't be reactive to those people that you used to have issues. When I see people who steal, I don't react negatively to it anymore. But I used to, because of my own guilt. And that's what it was. Well, that's the same thing in the fourth column. We're going to ask God to help us see this differently for my benefit. And the more I've worked with that inventory and freed myself from that stuff, the less reactive I've been. And I'm not so reactive. Once in a while, I'll bump into something. You know, Bill said it in the 12 and 12 in the 10th step. He said it's a spiritual axiom that every time we are disturbed, no matter what seems to be the cause, there's something wrong with us. See, I always want to look at you when I'm upset. He's saying, look at yourself. You can't do anything about it. Yeah, that guy might need to change. That guy needed to stop stealing. But the truth of the matter was, I was reactive because of my own guilt. You know, I had this big shot stuff going on, too. You know, when I got sober, I always wanted to be a big shot. That kind of crap, you know. We don't talk much about big shotism anymore around AA. But in the early fellowship, it's written all over the fellowship. All over the writings, Bill is talking about it, because Bill was a big shot. He wanted to be a big shot. These guys were lawyers, doctors, stockbrokers. They were professional people. And they warned constantly about that sort of thing. Well, you know, you can come into AA and do that stuff too, you know, and start thinking you're really something here. It's an easy thing to do. Yeah. Start buying your own press, you know, you get impressed with yourself. Look. I'm telling you, I've had to look at this. This isn't pleasant. I'm telling you things that have been very difficult, that I've struggled with, that I've had to deal with. But, you know, here's something that helped me with big shotism. The highest you can become in Alcoholics Anonymous is the elite of the mentally ill. Now, that's something to strive for, huh? Yeah. Well, I think of that whenever I start thinking I'm something. Boy, that's the best you got here. You know, you can be very sincere about your nonsense, too. You know, I heard this quote a while back. It comes from, it wasn't AA stuff, but it says, sincerity is not enough. What we need is honesty. And the student says, what's the difference? And the guy says, honesty is a never-ending openness to the facts. Sincerity is believing one's own propaganda. That's right. You know what I've seen here? When I wrote an inventory with my dad, and I had all kinds of justification for my anger toward him, I wrote out my story in three columns of why I was angry. I come to the fourth column, I ask God to help me see it differently. That's all that goes on in between the first three columns and the fourth column. God, help me see this differently. Then you go in with an open mind asking for help. And then the fourth column, referring to our list again, putting out of our minds the wrongs they did, I resolutely looked for my own mistakes. Where was I selfish? I have rarely gotten past the word selfish without having a significant experience. You know what I saw with my dad? I made decisions and choices. I hadn't talked to him in 15 years. My life fell apart because there were stupid choices and decisions based in selfishness. I wanted what I wanted. I lost my family. I lost my business. I lost my house. I lost my money. I had no friends. Everything was gone when I walked into AA. I didn't want to be responsible. I was still that five-year-old giving everybody else the problem. So I told myself, yeah, it's because of my childhood. And I had people telling me I was right. Probation officers, school officials, you know. Oh, yeah, I had society on side with that, see. I saw through it. I realized, my God, it wasn't him, it was me. I was doing it to myself. Now, you'd think that would make you feel guilty, but it didn't. It took away my guilt. Why? Because I was hating my dad for my mistakes. Who are you hating when you're hating somebody else for the mistakes you've made? I'm hating myself outside of myself. So what we're going to do is we're going to forgive ourselves by seeing others differently. And that's really what the sense of the inventory in AA is. That's what the sense of that guy was who was a thief. I had changed my behavior, but I was hanging on to the judgment about it. I let go of the judgment about it. Now I don't feel that. I'm not reactive. Doesn't mean people don't need to change, but I'll tell you, you'll come from love instead of aggressiveness and demand. And I don't, you know, you don't have to fire sponsees and stuff. I mean, I see people do this around Minneapolis. I don't understand it. It makes no sense. Put inventory in front of them. That'll weed them out in no time. They'll leave in a hurry. You'll find out who's interested and who isn't. So when I saw that with my dad, I sat down and I wrote my dad a letter. I saw I was wrong. And it was devastating because I'd been treating him for 25 years as if he ruined my life. And now I've had this experience where I saw he didn't do it, I did it to myself. But I'd been hating him and treating him as if he ruined my life for 25 years. Wow, I felt pretty crappy about that. So I sat down and I wrote him a letter and I thanked him for staying sober from the time I was 11, hoping I could walk in his shoes in recovery. This is what I got back. This is dated February 25th, 1988. He's 20 years sober when he wrote this. He's a guy who swept his alcoholism under a rug, didn't talk to anybody, didn't talk to the family. Unfortunately, he didn't follow what it says in the big book with that stuff. And he paid a big price with my older siblings with him. I got one brother who died drunk, angry at him, another brother who's just angry. Okay? I didn't do that. I took an inventory and I got honest and I wrote the first letter. So here's what I get back. He says, "Dear Rick, I got your very welcome letter today. Believe me, it was a very wonderful expression of your feelings and your desire and courage to change your life around. I wrote this letter. I thanked him for staying sober from the time I was 11, hoping I could walk in his shoes in recovery." He says, "I know how difficult it is to turn 180 degrees, but I know you can do it. You are going about it in the right way. I am very proud of you." It's a man who never talked of his feelings. You know, Rick, we people in AA never get through making amends to people we have hurt. I have hurt you as well as my other kids. I can never complete making amends. There are some people I can never make amends to because they are gone. I can never make amends to my mother as I should have. Sad, he never had a chance to clean it up with her. I can never make amends to your mother as I should have. He was 6 years sober when she died. He never cleaned up his mess with her. Sad, isn't it? I just have to do the next best thing, and that is to work this AA program the best I can and constantly try to put into practice those seven little words of step 12. Practice these principles in all our affairs. Rick, you have made amends to me in a way you'll never realize. Just keep on doing things as you are now doing, and you will find a great life ahead of you. I do realize, when you get well, you heal your parents. Do you understand that? Otherwise, you're holding up a picture of a broken person, and they feel responsible. I know this from being in Al-Anon. Parents come in all the time feeling like they hurt their kids. If I just would have done this different or that different, because their kids are using. I look at them, I say, look, if you think you can screw them up, why don't you just fix them? Well, if you have that kind of power, you should be able to fix them, right? You know? Your mother loved all you kids very much, but you must remember she was very sick from the booze and was not responsible for her insane behavior. She was sick. Nobody talked about her death. Now he's talking. But your mother was a very good mother. She nursed you kids through your sick spells many times, and she kept you clean and healthy. I was to an AA meeting last night. Interesting how it coincided with my first letter. I heard somebody say how they had feelings of guilt about someone they had failed to try to help, and it brought back memories of my own guilt feelings. See, I didn't know this till he wrote this. He says, I had promised Bill, that's my brother who died drunk, angry at my dad. I had promised Bill I was going to try to get some woman at the club to see her, my mother, but I kept putting it off until it was too late. So I have had my share of guilt feelings. I have to use that serenity prayer a lot. Isn't that sad? A lot of regret here. 20 years in the program, he's got all these regrets. It's unfortunate. He's a good man. Rick, we are all responsible for our own behavior, but sometimes we become so sick we can't control ourselves and we become overwhelmed. But thanks to AA, we have tools to work with and people who support us. I want to thank you for your wonderful letter. You owe me nothing. I told him I'd pay him any money, whatever I had to do to straighten it out with him, I would do. You owe me nothing. I am very happy to hear how well you are doing. Your mother would be very happy for you. This is making amends too. I'm enclosing a couple of cards for you and Pam to carry. It's a very special poem for me. I sometimes pass them out when I speak at meetings down here in Florida. I think the meaning is very good. That's the man in the glass card, if you haven't seen it. You don't have to live up to other people's expectations, but if you're not okay with yourself, it's going to be a nightmare. The guy in the mirror, you got to be okay with yourself. This will be all for now, Rick. Greet Pam for me and also Austin and Wyatt. Love to all of you and keep the faith, Dad. I didn't expect this from him. You know why I wrote that first letter? To clean up my mess, because I'd been treating him as if he ruined my life and I was wrong. And I've seen more people come through this same process and have huge shifts in the inventory process. I just helped some young gal who wasn't getting help. She's 18, 19 years old. She came into our meeting. She's struggling, and she wants to kill herself. She's drinking. Now she's 23. She's been in and out a lot, young Asian gal. And she did a little bit. I says, you got to do some inventory, because she'd been to a workshop that we had done, and she hadn't written it out. She knew what it was, but she hadn't done it, see? I says, you got to do something with this stuff. You're going to die if you don't, because she wants to kill herself now, see? She's just insane when she's drinking. She says, my sponsor won't let me. I said, you got to be kidding me. I don't care what your sponsor says. If you don't do something, you're going to die. So she wrote that day. I met her that night for dinner. She had a huge shift. We talked a little bit about some things. She had more of a shift, and it was like a fifth step, sort of a mini thing we did. And then 2 days later, she sends me this on a text. She says, have you ever had a back massage, a really good one, that works out all those kinks and knots, and afterwards you're so loosened up, you're almost uncomfortable because you're not used to feeling that way? That's how my mind is today. My thoughts don't hurt me today. And I have these moments of sadness, but there is none of the heart-wrenching pain that I was feeling for so long. Wow. A few minutes of writing, you know. She had that shift. She's still sober. I asked, she sent me a text a couple days later. She says, I don't think I'll have to drink anymore. Wow. That's the experience of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's the inventory. You know, we're talking about love here, guys. I mean, this is, you know how I learned how to love? Grizzly Adams taught me. No, really. Remember Grizzly Adams, the mountain man? He'd walk with the bear in the field? Yeah. And I was grounded a lot, so I watched a lot of TV. Well, I'm watching Grizzly Adams one day. He's out in the field with the bear. The bear's name was Ben, I think. And somebody comes up and says, hey, Grizzly, meaning the man, why don't you tie the bear up? Aren't you afraid he'll run away? He says, if the bear don't want to be here, I don't want to keep him. That's love. Hey, if Pam don't want to come back, I don't want to keep her. Why would I want to keep somebody with me who doesn't want to be with me? Because I'm selfish and I want what I want and I don't care what they want. If the sponsee doesn't want to be here, I don't have to beat him over the head or get angry with him. Let him be. I heard Bill when he said, don't argue with people who aren't interested in this way of life. You might be denying somebody else an opportunity because you're fighting with this lunatic. Leave him alone, you know? You don't have to be mean to them. You don't have to be abusive and push them out of the program. That crap is just giving AA a black eye. I think it's terrible. You don't have to do that. The booze will chase them back in. And maybe they'll die. I don't know. That happens too, you know. We don't have any control over that stuff. Al-Anon has made me safer. There's no question about it with my sponsorship. So In a member's eye view of Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm going to close with this. This guy says something that I hope I've been saying, at least I wanted to. He says, there must come a day, it seems to me, when every alcoholic, in or out of AA, finally sits down in the presence of his enemies. That's what we do with inventory. We sit down with the people we're angry at. In our mind, we're writing it. When he does, he will be amazed to discover he is attending a meeting of one, himself. That's what I saw. The day the alcoholic in AA realizes that his enemy is within, that the tigers are largely creatures of his own design and lurk in his own unconscious, That is the day when, for him, AA becomes what I believe its founders meant it to be, a flight into reality. Wow, it sounds like the Twilight Zone, doesn't it? How much reality do I see today? I don't know. You know, it's different today. It's gentle. I had a relationship with my dad. He moved back from Florida. I used to pick him up every week, and we'd drive over to the Union Gospel Mission and put on a meeting together. And him and I had a great relationship. And when he died just a few years ago, I had no heartache with him. I had no grief because I had no unfinished business with him. When you got unfinished business, it's a nightmare when somebody dies. So it's been different for me. And my brother Bob is still bound up with his stuff, and it's sad, but it's the way it is. He's not a member of AA. He's just a normal guy, and he's angry, and he's probably going to live his life out that way. But I'm so grateful. I am just so grateful for the inventory process and the honesty, just the honesty with myself. It's made all the difference in the world. So thanks a lot for the opportunity to be here tonight. I appreciate it.